I've been walking a tightrope between fact and fiction. Been wrestling with demons in small bottled prisons. Been talking to sinners who claim to be Christian, but shouting at leaders who claim to be listening. And the pendulum swings, but I can't stop the pull. Our elections are travesties paid for in full by a gang full of sellouts who worship a bull. Why can't it all just be free?
Hi, this is Christina Tobin. Hello again to our wonderful listeners, and welcome to the Free and Equal Network. I'm pleased to introduce to you a lovely lady I met last year during our second presidential debate. She was one of our political correspondents. Her name is Maitha Alhassan. She can tell you a bit about herself. She is actually one of our speakers at the upcoming United We Stand Fest. And wow, she has, I mean, from journalism to academic writings, she's appeared on CNN and Al Jazeera English and contributed to an essay to a book on American Muslim women's stories. I speak for myself. Maitha, you can introduce yourself better than anyone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to have you.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to have this conversation with you.
Me too. You have done so many things. I don't even know how to introduce you because you're a woman of many different amazing traits. You're a Syrian-American doctoral student, journalist, and artist. Can you tell our supporters who are listening today a little bit about yourself and how I guess we connected and just who you are?
Yeah, so I actually, my parents were both born in Syria. My father is from the city of Aleppo, which in the news, I'm sure your listeners have heard a lot about it. And I know it in very different terms. I know it as a city that has long been, has been the longest historically inhabited city in the world and is rich in human history and culture and art. And I'm very proud to be from there. And I guess we'll go into the interview. When we go into the interview, we'll talk about how deplorable things are over there right now. But I know it again in different terms. And my mother comes from Latakia, but she was mostly raised in Lebanon and she had to flee Lebanon with her family at the start of the civil war. So we've been a byproduct of a lot of these movements, a lot of war in the Middle East, but also a lot of beauty. So my parents got married. We were all born and raised in the suburbs of Southern California, and I'm definitely a SoCal girl. I went to UCLA for undergrad, lived in New York for 2 years, and then got my master's at Columbia. And that's kind of the place where I coalesced this relationship with the arts and politics and tried to figure out a space for having political dialogue through art. When I came back to Los Angeles, I started my PhD program at USC. And as I was doing that, these uprisings started to happen. And I was teeing a class on exploring ethnicity through film. And it was just this contemporary class on ethnicities in the U.S. And that's when the Tunisian and the Egyptian uprising started to happen. And I was like, oh my God, this is such a historical moment and doesn't really relate to the class that I'm TAing. How do I bring in this conversation? And I just saw myself becoming sucked into the events of the region. And then, of course, Syria happened. And the book that you had mentioned, the I Speak for Myself book, the publishers of that book approached me and asked if I would co-edit a volume on the uprisings in the Arab world. And at that time, it was still kind of early to figure out which countries were uprising or starting revolutions, or were they revolutions? Like, there was a lot of question mark on what we call what was happening in the region. So I got another fellow Arab journalist to be my co-editor, Ahmed Shihabuddin, who's now a Huffington Post Live host. And we had met doing work at Al Jazeera. He started a program called The Stream there and was the co-host and digital producer. And so we put together this book of essays from youth who have these eyewitness reports of what was going on. And some of these youth were fundamental to the movement. Some were just responding to like Facebook invites, and we wanted to portray everything, or not everything, but we wanted a comprehensive portrait of what was happening from Morocco to Syria, where a lot of people just, you know, for whatever reason would focus on different movements or look at the top heavy political ramifications. But we really wanted to look at what youth were doing, and these movements, for even if they were co-opted afterwards by old guard parties or geopolitical interests, a lot of them were started by the youth, because the youth were being neglected and discarded, and they were the ones who were coming into an economy and a political situation where they had no future, no hopes, no dreams. And, you know, their final straw was that they were disrespected their dignity and their right to live a respectful, dignified life was consistently stomped on. So that's why we called the book Demanding Dignity.
And please go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it's a collection of 20 stories, and of course, striking a chord with my desire to portray like artistic movements. We included some song lyrics from songs that spoke about what was going on in the movements.
I would love for you to send that our way after our interview. And I see here on the Huffington Post that you have co-edited it with Ahmed. And he actually, Ahmed, and correct me if I'm wrong, Shihab El-Din, I'm sure the pronunciation of his name. And I met him last year when we did the Larry King debate. I had interviewed on Al Jazeera, and he was very kind and moderated amongst a group of us. And so Demanding Dignity, Young Voices from the Front Lines of the Arab Revolutions is the name of that book. And I look forward to us selling that on our store in the near future, and then you bringing that to any and all events to sell to the people, the students, and the future. More people need to read amazing books like that. So, so it's shifting to, you know, this is just a very special interview, a very timely interview for that matter. And again, last year when we connected through Amber Lyon, a mutual friend, you know, I've hung out with her quite a few times, and she's also a part of our fest this October at UCLA. And we've interviewed her. She's a, you know, 3-time Emmy Award winning journalist, CNN whistleblower. I'm not surprised the two of you are friends. And so I've learned a lot from Amber's perspective on the whistleblower end and that. But with you in Syria and learning about your family, we were kind of talking a little bit not so long ago. And I don't even know where to start. Your family was recently in Syria. I know you can't go into too much detail, but can you tell me a little bit? Let's just start with your thoughts on what's going on in Syria. You know better than most.
Yeah. Well, I can speak about the regions that I'm from, and I will definitely stop at certain details because I do not want to jeopardize the lives of my family members. And the reality is that giving too much information could. I do have family still in Latakia. My family in Aleppo left around last year, so there's some extended family that is still around there, but for the most part, most of the ones that I grew up around are gone. And you know, you just continue to hear stories about your family's houses, my grandfather's house that I that house that I had seen that he was born in 2010, you know, destroyed or whatnot. We won't know too much more of these details till, inshallah, as we say, there is some sort of end. Who knows? Who knows when I'd be able to, me and my family would be able to go back. My family in Latakia, there are some that have been able to leave. Now, the issue is that there are some that have been able to make it to Gulf countries where they have more family. But the thing is, in these countries, you only get a 30-day visa. So there have been points in the year during this conflict that they've gone to a Gulf country, stayed for 30 days, and had to go back. And the sad part about this is some of these Gulf governments are supplying millions of dollars in arms and military training. And the very people they supposedly, allegedly want to help and defend they won't open their arms up for them to go into their countries. So this is what's made me a little more than suspicious, just really, I can't even find a better word than pissed off. Just really pissed off that we're stuck in the situation where there really isn't an interest or intention to preserve some sort of humanity. So that's kind of the portrait of my family and my family in Syria. Now, I have friends that are still there, and I talk to them trying to figure out what's going on. I've had a friend who's a journalist, Anthony Shadid. He's a journalist for the New York Times who went in, and I'm sure a lot of your viewers know his story. As on his way out, he died, not necessarily due to conflict, but to conditions. And I've had friends who've been kidnapped. I've had friends who've been detained by the regime, kidnapped by extremist fundamentalist groups. So I've for ransom, you know, and that's kind of interesting, is that this has become, unfortunately, an international sort of brigade conflict. So people from different countries that either feel like they're on a religious mission or want to make some money are going there. I mean, and that's the second part of what I mentioned. Making money is something we're not talking about. We are talking about the religious jihadist interest to go, and some of these Salafis in different countries that I've heard, like Libya, Tunisia, Egypt, or other Muslim countries that don't speak Arabic, have gone and converged on Syria and seen it as a moment to revive some sort of Islamic state. There's a group called Islamic State Iraq Syria Islamic State, ISIS. They want to create an Islamic state between Syria and Iraq, and they've been one of these really deplorable extremist groups inside Syria. So this has been a moment for anybody to like wage a stake and make money. And it's sad because it's being done over the bloodshed of hundreds of thousands of bodies.
Yeah, I was reading 4.25 million Syrian refugees as of today displaced within the country. And of course, the 1,429 casualties in the last month, the horrible chemical attack, and the attack on the suburb in Damascus. Can you tell us a little bit about your feelings on that? Automatically, you know, America seems to be assigning blame, and weapon experts say it looks like an accident. So just want to get your feedback on that.
Yeah, so I was traveling abroad when I heard the news. It was August 21st, that they reported about Al-Ghouta, which is a suburb of Damascus. Chemical warfare had started there. And there were also claims of chemical weapons used earlier in this year. And I just thought it was kind of bizarre because, again, I was traveling, so I wasn't as attached to up-to-date media of what was happening. But I had thought to myself, wait, isn't this around the time the UN weapons inspectors are supposed to arrive into Damascus? And sure enough, the inspectors had come the day before. And so to me, if the Assad regime wanted to launch a chemical weapons attack on their own population, it just didn't make sense why they would do it the day after weapons inspectors would be coming into the country. So for me, it's just the situation is very ambiguous, especially since it had triggered a response from the U.S. And as you had mentioned, I've spoken to some weapons inspectors, and it does, for them, it does sound like it could have been an accident or this chemical agent, I believe it was sarin that they suspected was used, was improperly launched. Or some people will argue that the rebels didn't have the kind of equipment that needed to be to launch the sarin. Christina, I honestly don't know. It just doesn't make sense. As I had mentioned, for the Assad regime to be doing that. And of course, we've got reports afterwards from, I think even the Washington Post published a story that UN weapons inspectors had said that this was not the Assad regime, this was the rebels. And I honestly don't know. So I'm just trying to use my critical thinking skills in that regard. I think the other question that should be asked, if this was a red line for the U.S., why wasn't it a red line for the use of white phosphorus by Israel in Gaza? Why wasn't it a red line for us to be using white phosphorus in Iraq? And there have been numerous moments of the use of chemical warfare in Iraq that we just turned a complete blind eye to. Also, and I'm sorry, I make a lot of these Iraq comparisons because I think we haven't even begun as a nation to dissect what we had done, what we won't even engage, and what will continue to be part of the legacy of what Iraqis are going to be living with, including a lot of mutations, including birth defects.
It's almost like forgetting a catastrophe, and we can't do that. You know, these are human beings in whatever country, Iraq and Syria, and makes me really upset. You know, I'm very, it makes me really sad, and it makes me want to fight harder every day, and I'm sure many others, I would hope as well, to unite as not only a country, the United States of America, but as, you know, one world. You know, just these good people that are needlessly dying, and because of terrorists that, you know, Ben Swan, you know, Honest Media there said himself, you know, the CIA, Al-Qaeda is a, you know, creation of our own CIA. It just, the more I learn about the ties and the connections amongst terrorists and the monetary system and the elite controlling the two-party system, and dig deeper into the pharmaceutical industry and the gas and the electric, and just all makes sense that everything yeah. wraps around the finger of greed. Yeah. And it's not a majority of people. I think a minority of people are greedy. A majority just want to live a good, simple life. It just, to think that whether it's a child, you know, or an adult, just human beings, I want it to stop, and I will continue, and I'm sure you will as well, to do what we can to, and I do see one day peace rising throughout not only the U.S., but the world. The whole world is watching the U.S. right now, right. And when peace rises here, it will just spread beautifully throughout the world.
You know, and I try to rely on that buttress of hope and of optimism for the world, and I'm just naturally that person. So I definitely feel your vision for the world. I think what is unfortunate in these situations, as you mentioned, that there are greedy people who would exploit and take advantage of any situation to amass more money and power, and unfortunately, what's really putting me in a place of dejection is that when I look at Syria and when I look at Iraq, all I see as the real winners are the arms dealers and the contractors, you know? And so it's interesting that right. if we remember the sort of war propaganda that was around World War II, that our economy started booming in the 50s because war is good for an economy, we have to be very realistic about like what the actual history is. War is good for certain entrepreneurs of the military industrial complex, not all of society, right? There were so many families that had to endure losses and continue to in this military industrial complex. So I am seeing the U.S. wake up to the extreme disadvantages of that mentality and mind state, and how it doesn't serve them. It doesn't serve the grassroots, common person and I don't even want to say common, just people, just ordinary, normal people every day. It doesn't serve us to send our 18-year-old boys over to fight something we don't understand, you know? And for these young boys to also be doing the dirty work of empire, and for these young boys to kill other young boys and babies and women.
I agree, and we need to put a stop to the needless violence and death. And I was listening to an interview by Dr. Ron Paul recently, and I typed down exactly word for word of him saying, "War always expands because of unintended consequences. Look for what's best of America. American people are, a majority are opposed to this war, not trying to pick sides, you know, whatever side won't be the side of the people. The Constitution can't support this war," and is referring to Syria, of course, "and morally we cannot support this war." And digging a little deeper, a quote of Dr. Ron Paul, falsely blaming the Assad, that is, government, for a so-called massacre perpetrated by a violent warring rebel faction is nothing more than war propaganda, said Dr. Ron Paul when he took the, you know, House floor to tell the warmongers, that is, to leave Syria alone.
Right. And, you know, a couple of thoughts I have in reaction to that. One is I'm also not a fan of the military-industrial complex, and I know Dr. Ron Paul had spoken on his when he was running last year, he had spoken on his interest to dramatically reduce the amount of military outposts globally that we have, right? My reaction is that if we are genuinely concerned with humanitarian issues that are extreme travesties, why don't we ever talk about Congo? What's happening in Congo right now is the most bloody conflict since World War II. So that should tell you that there are only certain kinds of humanitarian crises that we are interested in, right? And there's also Muslims dying in Myanmar right now, and Buddhists are launching, you know, we think of all Buddhists being peaceful, but Buddhists are launching extreme attacks on the Muslim populations in Myanmar. So there are conflicts all over the world. There's a question of why we never intervene in Rwanda, because we actually don't care about African issues, right? We care about issues that have geopolitical significance to us. And geopolitical significance usually has to deal with resources. And so since we haven't discovered the resources that Africa is very rich in, we haven't begun this sort of campaign around what regions of influence we want to have. So, you know, my heart bleeds for every sort of humanitarian crisis. And the other reaction is that I just can't help but really be in pain for the fact that we don't really care about including these Syrian voices. And this sort of tug of war, this is another part of the story that I think is not part of our national media, the sort of tug of war of whether or not we should get involved or sending harsh words to Assad is actually endangering the population in Syria, because it is this hesitancy. Well, I know that I'm personally against foreign intervention, but we have already been involved by either training the rebels or supplying weaponry through other governments, right? But what my friends and family in Syria are saying, this sort of, we might strike you, we might not, is actually emboldening Assad's regime, because Assad can now look strong. And so the hesitancy on our part has led to that. And I'm not advocating for any sort of strike, but I am sadly hearing a population that is desperate to have anything to remove Assad, because what's happening right now is that these extremist groups are gaining ground. And so they feel that if Assad would go, then this conflict would end and they could put some sort of transitional government. I don't necessarily subscribe to that because I've seen what's happened in Iraq, but this is the sentiment I'm getting from people that are in Syria. And it was hard for me to believe, but the one thing that I do now understand after talking to people this weekend was that when you're drowning, you don't look for what hand for okay, I'll restate that. When you are drowning and somebody puts their hand out, you don't look at whose hand that belongs to. And that's the sad, desperate state of where these people are at. So I think we have to empathize with the fact that people are so desperate that they want foreign intervention. This is not something that they wanted. You see what I'm saying? So I'm in this very complicated state where, in terms of my critical analysis, where I see the long end game that foreign intervention never pans out in the people's favor, for most part. You know, some people will use the case of Kuwait and when Iraq invaded in the first Persian Gulf War. There's many other moments, Afghanistan, Iraq, Vietnam, anything else that you can kind of think about that has turned into a protracted war on the U.S.'s side, where it hasn't panned out well for the local population. But, you know, we also have to acknowledge that we're not enduring daily shellings, so we don't know what it's like for people to want help, right? And I'm just, you know, at my wit's end, Christina, because I from the start, I kind of felt that if we really wanted to actually save a lot of people, I don't think military strikes saves people. I think engaging in a diplomatic route could have. I think having talks with Russia could have. But then again, I'm not really involved in the behind the scenes affair of state politics on an international scope. So, yeah, that's my...
That sort of in response to your quote of, you know, and of people reaching out and grabbing whatever hand comes. And, you know, for me, I have to say I'm 100% a proponent of no war. And well, there's no war, Syria, no war, you know, under a government where money doesn't control it, the elite, the greed, where the people take back control of their own government. It has utmost integrity, and that can be achieved with a movement, not only grassroots on the ground of uniting from Occupy leaders to Tea Party leaders that have been disenfranchised, you know, as it has been co-opted by the system, to independent Democrats, Republicans, just we the people, third party leaders coming together, not only in a grassroots level, but through social media technology. When we bring about integrity within our government and honest media rising, the music industry, it's just so simple, you know, and Hollywood of having music with meaning, everything's been so suppressed and intentionally so to play into the system. And when we rise and bring the integrity and make it fun and positive and powerful and educational and create a free and equal, I guess you could say, level playing field for these candidates to get elected. I think parties have become a real big issue in dividing us. And divisiveness is not, we are all one under spirituality, arts, music. It is a common denominator. And I see, as I always say, history being on our side, a shifting in that way. I think that, you know, we are being sucked in to Syria. It's not the people. The people there, I can't speak for them, but it seems as if they're similar to the people here in America and Iraq, and they want peace. They want to live the short amount of lifetime that we have, living in peace with their loved ones and enjoying life. And it feels like it's a big risk. You know, China is not even talked about. You know, we were kind of discussing a little bit before we started this interview. Of course, Russia, a lot more than China. That definitely piques my curiosity there. I don't know if you have any feedback on that or...
Yeah, I'm also, I just kind of want to say from the outset, I'm not somebody who is an expert on trying to understand geopolitics beyond the Middle East. So when I've consistently seen discussion about the UN resolutions in the Security Council being stalled by Russia and China, the next line in the media is about the U.S. relationship to Russia and what Russia has done and Russia's interest in Syria. And then I completely see China ignored in the media. And I have a lot of questions about what China's interests are, what China's involvement could be, or why we're not talking about China. Is it too politically costly to kind of draw them into this discussion? And is it just easier to relive these Cold War binaries of U.S. versus Russia? And I don't know. That's just been a lot of question marks coming to my mind.
But it seems... Oh, go ahead.
No, go on.
It seems like, you know, Russia, China, whatever countries, as we transition historically into the times of now, I mean, every problem we have, it just all points to the monetary system, the central banks, allegedly world order. Some say Bilderberg, it seems to be. You know, there's a group of leaders allegedly coming together throughout the world of countries this week, next week. The monetary, the money, it seems that everything is just all tied to the money. And like you said, who do you feel is profiting from this war in Syria? It's definitely not the people.
Yeah, of course. It's not the people. And that's why I've kind of struggled to figure out what my role in this is from so far away, and my repeated attempts to try to figure out how to go in and help or help with the refugee crisis and try to be that hand instead of another hand that's trying to save the drowning person. I honestly don't know the exact names of the people who are benefiting, and I think that also is part of why we don't talk about who are the benefactors of these wars, because, you know, if we know, then we have fingers to point at. And I think I know that people have spoken about the central banks and the monetary system and how they're at fault and how we never even began to prosecute those involved, or the mortgage crisis in 2008, and how Iceland actually did. And Iceland is kind of reviving itself from creating local markets by creating local markets. Actually, I worked with a professor at USC. His name is Manuel Castells, and he wrote a book called Networks of Hope and Outrage. And he looked at what was happening in Iceland and how they took a different course. And he looked at the Occupy movements, and I helped him on the section on the uprisings. And he kind of tried to look at the common themes between the social movements that took place there. So it was really, studying Iceland was revealing to me about the paths we could have taken in the U.S. that we didn't. And I think it is a monetary system. I think it is a military system. I think it is these complexes that we don't even begin to understand because we haven't mapped them out and we don't know who's responsible for these complexes. And sometimes I think there are people to blame, but I sometimes also think that when you're talking about systems, there are people who benefit from systems. And it's not necessarily that human beings are inclined to want to do bad, as you had mentioned. But I think that we let systems rule us versus the human heart. So that's how we can become divorced from the pain that these systems cause.
And on that note, we've had definitely quite a few supporters this week really want to know my stance on Syria. And I think I've made it very clear, no war, you know, no needless death. And I know great things are going to come out of this movement. May, I want to thank you so much for being a part of our United We Stand Festival this October 12th at UCLA. UCLA has just rolled out the red carpet for us. We got the Pauley Pavilion. Even the basketball team was so kind enough to change the date for their recruitment. That's a big deal for UCLA, for us to have the Pauley Pavilion. Yeah. And so they're really seeing as this is an exciting, they're internally already announcing it as a global event. And I can't even begin to tell you, May, we have three, soon to be five, six, seven PR firms stepping up and helping us. And I see great things, you know, knowing Sean Stone, sitting down, Oliver Stone's son, and having a quick lunch with him. He wants to produce things in the future. You know, he's the next generation in a whole different way. And so I do see great things coming about, whether it's documentaries. I do know there's interest of documentaries about Syria. I think you're a perfect fit. There's just something that's going to fall into place. And that's what this movement is about. It's about connecting and building. And I think some of my happiest moments is just going to be standing at the end of the room and seeing everybody just getting to know each other and the connections. And we're really going to catch the system off guard. They aren't going to see us coming. They're prepared, but they're not prepared for this. And that's great. It's so positive that the people that are paid within the system, I see them becoming a part of this movement. Because when it comes down to it, whether you're the elite, you're the at the federal level, the Democrats, Republicans, and so on, it's going to impact all of our families. If the system shifts in the way that it's going to, we are not going to be safe if we don't come up with a solution. So I feel that really all or most, I hope all human beings are going to support the solution and what we're doing and building others. So May, thank you so much. I want to plug your website. I have one here, May Alhassen. That's A-L-H-A-S-S-E-N. Again, that's May, May A-L-H-A-S-S-E-N. ASSEN.com for our listeners. Check her out. I just see you doing great things in the future, May, to make the world a better, a peaceful place.
Thank you. And I see the work you're doing. And of course, I've just been in awe of all the organizing and your commitment to love, truth, and integrity. And so I'm, you know, all for that and in great admiration and jumping on your bandwagon.
I look forward to hanging out and having dinner with you and Amber soon. And lots of love to you, May. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to the Free and Equal Network. Thank you so much for your time today, for this thought-provoking. I've learned so much from May today, and I look forward to learning more from her in the future. And thank you so much for coming on the show today, the Free and Equal Network. Lots of love to all of you. Take care.